And we're still thinking and talking a little bit about Bob Dylan here on WGN Radio. The movie has gotten good reviews. I just thought it was so much fun. But it was based on a book called Dylan Goes Electric, Dylan, Seeger, Newport, and The Night That Split the 60s. The book was written by Elijah Wald, and I think the press date was 10 years ago now. And the New York Times review started out this way. Saturday night is the 50th anniversary of Dylan-geddon, the night Bob Dylan savaged the Newport Folk Music Festival by making loud, electrified noise at a sanctuary that had never been thus sullied. The story of his 1965 assault on Newport is very well known. Its effects have been contemplated ad nauseum. Its details show up in every Dylan biography. It's so essential to the Dylan story that it may even have engendered folk songs of its own, so the idea of a book to recommend this geezer milestone seems unnecessary, to put it kindly. But what a surprise Dylan Goes Electric turns out to be. This splendid, colorful work of musicology and cultural history is written by Elijah Wald, whose broad range of other books demonstrates his broad base of knowledge. He is best known for The Mayor of McDougal Street, a collaborative book. It says in the review that that book was a labor of love, and this one reads like that, too. Elijah, do you just take that out every now and then and read it to yourself?
No, but I won't deny that it was a pleasure hearing it again.
How about that? So thanks for joining us here on WGN. So just walk me through this description of your relationship to Bob Dylan's story and then the movie, which has since come out. I said that the movie was based on the book. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, it's loosely accurate. Dylan's people licensed the book about a year after it came out. And they were for the film, and they were behind making the film. I have to say my initial reaction when they licensed it is, why do they need my book? They have Dylan. But after watching the movie, what I invented in that book was the idea of telling the story of Dylan going electric by telling the story of Dylan and Pete Seeger. My book starts with a chapter on Pete Seeger and then brings in Dylan and sort of traces them up to that moment where they go head-to-head at Newport. And the film takes that idea and personalizes it. They weren't actually in the same rooms a lot, so the film has created all of these fictitious moments in which Dylan and Seeger meet almost as soon as Dylan arrives in New York, and are regularly seeing each other, and their relationship is evolving positively for a while and then begins to get strained. And it's interesting to me because those scenes are fictitious, but I think they very accurately trace what was happening with both people and with that musical scene in that period.
So the movie we're talking about is obviously A Complete Unknown with Timothée Chalamet as Bob Dylan. So that opening scene where the three of them are in a hospital room never happened then?
No. Yeah. Pretty much everything about that scene is fictitious.
And you know, it doesn't sound like that bothers you. It doesn't sound like that bothers you that much.
No, not at all. I mean, it's true. It is true that Dylan came to New York in order to see Woody Guthrie. He certainly didn't take a cab by himself right out to Greystone Hospital. He probably hadn't yet written song to Woody. When he met Woody, Pete Seeger wasn't in the room. But he wrote that song very soon. He did visit Woody regularly in the hospital. Pete Seeger did also visit Woody. The two of them did meet fairly early. Pete was excited by Dylan's songwriting and, in fact, was the first person to present him on stage at a large concert. So, you know, taking all those facts and making it flow better on screen by, you know, sort of pushing them together into a smaller space felt fine to me.
Yeah, right.
Honestly, you know, I have to say, I went into the movie worried that a lot of it would feel wrong to me. And that first scene, and I've had other people have the same reaction, that first scene, I went, oh, okay. They've decided to fictionalize this, but they're doing a very accurate job. I'm going to just sit back and go with that. And it made it easier for me to watch the rest of the film and just take it for what it was.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. And there's another documentary, which is a documentary of actual footage of Bob Dylan, if you want to actually see the TikTok of his days and something that's, you know, more accurate, if you will. But I'm glad to hear you say that it gets the characters right, that's what Pete Seeger was like, that's what Woody Guthrie was like. Is that what Joan Baez was like? Are you saying that as well?
You know, there are things that are... One thing that a lot of people who are actually around that world have said, and I mean, I don't know Joan Baez well, but I knew Susie Rotolo, the character who they've named Sylvie Russo, who was Dylan's early girlfriend. And one thing a few people have complained about is that all of those people were a lot funnier and wittier than they are in the movie. I mean, particularly Joan and the Susie Rotolo character come across as pretty serious. And they were very bright, funny people. But no, overall, I think it does a very accurate job. And I should say about the documentary, on the flip side, if you watch the documentaries of Dylan going electric at Newport, he starts with Maggie's Farm and it finishes and you hear this mass of the crowd screaming and booing and having this mixed reaction. And that is spliced in from after he left the stage and people were booing because he left so early.
Oh.
Because the microphones didn't actually catch any reaction to Maggie's Farm because the band was so loud that they turned the stage mic way down. So that does bother me because the documentary is supposed to be a documentary, whereas a fictional film playing around with things a little seems to me completely legitimate.
Well, the idea that Dylan goes electric and that was a betrayal of the roots, or at least what was then contemporary folk music. Talk a little bit about that. How seminal was that and how controversial was that?
I mean, that's been wildly overblown because Dylan was always into folk roots and is into folk roots today. What Dylan was trying to escape was being trapped in this role of being a prophet and a sort of, you know, holy man of the folk scene and the left, and not the folk tradition. And honestly, you know, what happened at Newport, you have to remember, he'd already had two electric singles on the radio before he appeared at Newport. Hmm. Nobody was surprised that Dylan was doing electric music. What bothered people at Newport was that he was going on stage at a folk festival, which had been this huge, friendly, communal gathering of people who loved the same music and really felt, to a large extent, the same way about the world. And he had come the two previous years. He had always been bouncy and fun and joking with the audience and chatting with the audience. He'd been like one of them, one of the kids. And suddenly he was on stage in a black leather jacket with an electric guitar, turning his back on them, not saying a word to them, and then blasting out this music that felt to them like it was aggressive and he was rejecting them, which I don't think was an entirely incorrect reading of what was happening.
Yeah, and what about that? Why was he doing that?
I think a lot of reasons. First of all, it's easy to forget how frightening it was to be hailed as the voice of a generation in a moment when a lot of voices of the generation were getting shot. I mean, Esquire magazine did a cover that melded the heads of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Fidel Castro, and Bob Dylan, two of whom had been shot and one of whom the CIA was trying to kill. And all Bob Dylan was a folk singer. I mean, he had never set himself up to be the leader of anything. And all these other people were weighting him down with all these expectations that he'd never asked for. And he was only 24 years old, and it was scary. He was trying to pull away from all of that. The movie the movie has him still in this romantic triangle with Susie Rotello and Joan Baez at that point. But in fact, by that time, he had pulled away from all of that, was with Sarah Lowndes, who he married and had three children with, and was just trying to escape all of that. It also is a period where he was getting more into drugs. He was probably drunk that night. He was on stage with a band he had never played with before after one late-night rehearsal of a few hours, having never played with an electric band since high school. I mean, there were a lot of reasons that night was difficult.
That's interesting. Well, let me ask you about this, though. The expectation that he would be the voice of that generation, and he didn't want to be. I'm trying to remember now how I've been picking up on that, maybe from both movies, the documentary and also this new film. But he didn't. Did he sing or talk a lot about civil rights in Vietnam? And did he voice an opinion about that in his music, or did he just want to sing about the things that were on his mind and he didn't want to be looked to as some sort of voice?
Good question. The first thing I should say is Vietnam wasn't yet an issue. Vietnam became an issue the same weekend he went electric. That was the weekend that Lyndon Johnson doubled the draft, doubled the troops in Vietnam, and committed the U.S. to that war. So it had been all about civil rights, and that's one of the reasons that Dylan going electric marked this huge shift, that the huge shift was also happening, you know, in people's lives in other ways.
Yeah.
But the politics, so he arrived in New York without any particular politics, but rather quickly he got involved with Susie Rotello, who was from an old line communist family, Italian labor union family, and who was working full-time for CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. And she was a very strong leftist. And he was surrounded by other strong leftists. I mean, Greenwich Village was full of leftists of various kinds. And Pete Seeger, of course, was very engaged in the civil rights movement. He in fact, was one of the people who helped write We Shall Overcome. And so Dylan was very much pulled into that world. He was never a political thinker exactly, but he had strong feelings about injustice. And if you look at his political songs, most of them are songs in which he gets one person who he sympathizes with and tells their story. And I think at that level, you know, viscerally, he had a strong sense of injustice. But then he and Susie start to break up, and he did the record. You know, that was the Times They Are a Changing record, was political. And the next record, he and Susie are breaking up, and he did Another Side of Bob Dylan, which are all personal songs.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the end of that. And, you know, people get mixed up and talk about how when he stopped doing political songs and went electric, all these people got upset. The stopping doing political songs was Another Side of Bob Dylan, which was still completely acoustic, and the political people got upset about it.
Yeah.
And it was a year later that he went electric.
Bob Dylan movie, which came out last year, and a lot of us just enjoyed so much out of nowhere, or pardon me, A Complete Unknown. And I wonder, what did you think of the movie in general? You said you were happy with it. Did you? What did you think of Timothée Chalamet's performance?
Well, he's terrific. And, you know, I reacted to that more as a musician than as anything else. I mean, he plays both the harmonica and the guitar parts unbelievably similarly to Dylan. I mean, he really has it down. And he sings this stuff really well. I thought all of the music in the movie, you know, that's one of the reasons I like the movie, is the music is so well done.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Did Pete Seeger try and take an axe to the cables when Dylan went electric?
No. I mean, that story, that's actually a funny story. Because the myth of Seeger trying to take an axe to the cables, when I went in to write the book, I mean, I knew he hadn't actually done it, but whether he tried to do it, I didn't know, and I didn't think I'd ever know, because there's so many different stories. But there's actually an answer to where that myth came from, which is that Seeger was upset. He was visibly upset, depending on where you were in the audience. You could actually see Seeger at the side of the stage fuming. And when Dylan went off after the electric set, before he came back on with an acoustic guitar, Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, who just died last week, was trying to calm the crowd and said the sentence, "He's gone to get his axe," meaning Dylan going to get his guitar, but it wasn't an audience full of hip jazz guys who referred to instruments as axes. So some people misunderstood, and Pete Seeger had earlier that weekend done a song on stage chopping a tree with an axe, and they put two and two together and got seven.
thank you for the clarification on that, although it's a hell of a dramatic scene, right? And it's more than apocryphal. It's just not true that he was wielding the axe backstage. One last thing then. Dylan does come back out, though, and the movie reflected this too, and then with an acoustic guitar rather accommodates Pete Seeger and the fans, right? Why did he do that, and what was the reaction then?
Yes. Sort of yes, sort of no. I mean, he sings "It's All Over Now, Baby Blue." Like, yeah, you know, "I'm back, I'm playing acoustic for you, but this is done now." In real life, he then, after that, played Mr. Tambourine Man, which is what they were all yelling for. As I sort of suggested earlier, it was a difficult and confusing evening for everybody. And that included Dylan. I mean, the whole thing felt, you know, nobody expected it. Nobody knew what to expect, but certainly nobody expected the level of passion that was out there in the audience. And it wasn't just about people who were unhappy with him. The other huge part of the story, which people keep forgetting, is he was by then a pop star. And there were 17,000 people in that audience, and probably 4,000 or 5,000 at least of them had come to Newport just to hear Dylan, and specifically hoping to hear Like a Rolling Stone, and had been being really obnoxious for the previous couple of days.
Interesting.
Running around being bored by the boring folk music and waiting for Dylan to show up.
So he did have some fans there.
There were already these two groups out there who were profoundly resentful of each other before he walked on stage. And when he left the stage having done three electric songs, they were as angry with each other, the people who were cheering and the people who were booing, as they were with him.
Elijah Wald, musician, writer, historian. Dylan Goes Electric, his book from several years ago, and the basis for A Complete Unknown. What a pleasure. What a great topic. And I'm really glad you gave us some time today, Elijah. Thanks for saying hi.
Thank you very much for having me.